From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Welcome to this Friday edition of Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships here, filling in for Tony Perkins. We have a ton to cover today, so let's get to it. It sounds like something out of George Orwell's novel, 1984. A source at Facebook has confirmed exclusively to Breitbart.com that the social media giant monitors the offline behavior of its users to determine if they should be categorized as hate agents. The document was provided exclusively to Breitbart by the source, who remains anonymous. Alex Marlow, editor-in-chief of Breitbart News Network, joins me to talk first about Big Brother. In my second segment, in an interview with the Des Moines Register on Tuesday, Democratic Senator Kristen Gillibrand, one of the 20-plus Dem presidential candidates vying for the White House, said that passing protective pro-life laws is akin to being a racist. Roland Warren, the African-American president of CareNet, a national Christ-centered movement of more than 1,000 life-affirming pregnancy centers, has something to say about that comparison. He'll join me to talk about it. At the bottom of the hour, in reaction to the Gillette campaign presenting masculinity as toxic, on this Father's Day, SecondVote.com celebrates the good in men who are made in God's image, uphold their creator's standard of integrity, and don't retreat when things get tough. Robert Kuykendall, executive director of SecondVote.com, will join me. And in my last segment, recent events in higher education have led many of us to include our thoughts on the fact that college campuses are hotspots for anti-Semitism. Dion Pierre, a research associate with the National Association of Scholars and co-author of the book Neo-Segregation in Higher American Education, joins me about his eye-opening Daily Signal column. As a reminder, you can find our podcast at tonyperkins.com. Follow Tony on Twitter at T Perkins or me at Sarah P. Perry. And before I jump into my first interview, a quick reminder to those of you listening. We have volunteers standing by to take your call to send a newborn baby hat for $9 to House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. We want to encourage her to allow the Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Act to finally come to the floor after 57 attempts as of today by Republicans to move it forward. So call 1-800-225-4008. Again, that's 1-800-225-4008. House Minority Whip Steve Scalise and Representative Ann Wagner have filed a discharge petition on the Born Alive Act. If 218 members sign the discharge petition, it would force Speaker Pelosi and House Dems to bring the bill to a vote. We are 17 member signatures away. We need your help, so join with us here at FRC and send a newborn baby hat to Speaker Pelosi as the bill is sitting in the House of Representatives. We are halfway to our goal of 90,000 hats. So call 1-800-225-4008, 1-800-225-4008. $9 sends a hat to Speaker Pelosi to remind her that there are those who cannot speak for themselves. Well, if you use a social media platform, you are probably aware that Silicon Valley corporations have a major censorship problem, and it seems to only be getting worse. Fresh off the story that Pinterest whistleblower Peter Cochran discovered pro-life content was being censored as nudity, it seems Facebook now has a whistleblower of its own. According to a document provided exclusively to Breitbart News by a source within Facebook, it apparently monitors the offline behavior of its users to determine whether they should be categorized as hate agents. The internal document titled Hate Agent Policy Review, outlines a series of signals that Facebook looks for to determine if someone ought to be categorized and banned from the platform. According to Alan Bokhari's Breitbart.com article, those signals include a wide range of on and off platform behavior. Joining me to talk about the issue is Alex Marlow, editor-in-chief of the Breitbart News Network. Alex, welcome to Washington Watch.
Sarah, thanks for having me. Great list of topics you got this hour.
Well, I will tell you that many of us are unfortunately and painfully not surprised. In fact, when I heard news of this, someone had emailed me here at work, and my response was, nothing surprises me anymore. I will say this, and I referenced it in the open, this feels a lot like George Orwell's novel, 1984. Do you all at Breitbart get the sense this is very Big Brother as well?
I have to say, if Orwell was alive today, he would be thinking, I missed it. I was so close and I missed it. He would be thinking that he's a completely uncreative person internally, I'm sure, because he was so close to seeing this coming. But I think this is even beyond what Orwell could have imagined now. We have essentially Facebook, and you're correct to note that Pinterest censoring Bible quotes. We also learned that Google has literal blacklists. Breitbart is on that for their news content. So this is, and they call it a blacklist. They're even clumsy enough to call it a blacklist. Daily Caller broke that this week. And then Breitbart broke yesterday, and with a first look to Tucker Carlson on his Fox show, we reported that Facebook has this hate agents list. In a nutshell, it's what we heard about with these with the China social credit score, where they're literally giving you what they refer to as a health score, Sarah. So it is, you get a point for what is deemed hate. And who defines hate? Facebook defines it. They don't totally explain what it is, and they track it going back years. And it's, as you noted in your intro, on and offline behavior. So it's not even stuff you post to Facebook necessarily.
The social credit standing in China was precisely the comparison that came to mind this morning when I read the piece on Breitbart. I thought the minute they begin to track offline behavior, it suddenly feels as though you are being watched round the clock. And there isn't a one of us who doesn't use a social media platform. And we know that all of the information is archived. There are chat message histories. All of this information is downloaded and saved. But to now include offline behavior as designated hate agent activity really makes the hairs on our arms stand up. In fact, there are a few different things that they look for. So designated hateful ideology is one category. Associating with a designated hate entity is another. Hate entities including, for example, critics of Islam. Hate symbols, hate tattoos. And now, for example, hate activity offline that might include referencing someone neutrally who falls in the previous categories. Do we have any specifics on this?
Yeah, we got a few specifics. And I want to go back to one of the examples of hate that you noted, which is associating, even the act of associating with people who are on the hate agents list. And they're going to keep adding to the list. I think what they have now is a pilot program. A few of the names have come out, and they're not radicals by any means. In many cases, like Candace Owens, for example, hardly a radical. Her whole message is just black people don't have to be Democrats. It seems pretty straightforward, non-controversial,
right.
Though it is, of course. There are many controversial people on it, so I'm not denying that there are some hateful people that would be on the list. But we know what the design is. The design is to test it out, to see if the public will tolerate this. And then if they do, they'll keep adding people to the list. But one thing that is noteworthy, they track violence, but only violence against designated groups. So groups that they deem as part of a victim or oppressed class. For example, illegal aliens, if you commit violence against an illegal alien, that's a hate point. There's no evidence that we have that they track violence against people who are non-protected classes. Christians come to mind. Whites come to mind, for example. FRC, you guys were attacked. I don't know if that would constitute as a hate agent point in this Facebook score based off of what we have. Yet, even speech directed at someone who is a protected class like a trans person saying men are men and women are women, for example, that very well might earn you a hate agent score. But literal violence against someone on the right might not.
It really does bring to mind these totalitarian big brother nanny states that we think are another problem, right? We think of communist China, we think of North Korea, and yet here we are dealing with social media platforms that, for all intents and purposes, present now the new public square. This is how we communicate with one another. We transmit volumes of information. You will know too well what we share on social media, what the impacts of that information are. So we can actually now be, according to Facebook, in this pilot program, and I love that description because really that is precisely what this is. There are three tiers of hate speech. Now, hate speech has been something about which we've been kicking out for some time. There have been some attempts to legislate a definition of this in Congress, but of course, being associated with, for example, a hate organization. I'm using very big air quotes here at FRC, because we are, as you know, on the SPLC's hate list alongside neo-Nazis and the KKK. Let's talk about hate speech. There are three tiers depending on the severity. So can you talk a little bit about the severity and what the signals are that they send?
Yeah, and the tiers are very strange. It's where it gets sort of muddled. Like, they even bother to note there's almost nothing funny about this. And I'm sure some of your listeners hear me on SiriusXM sometimes and know I try to have a good time. This is not one we can have a good time. But they do, for some reason, track genocide. Like, if you've committed genocide, then you get a hate point. I don't know how many Facebook users have committed genocide. So that's the only thing that's sort of darkly funny about this, that they're bothering to note, has this person committed genocide? And then the answer across the board so far is no. So the various tiers start with speech, and then it goes to have they associated with people who have are on the hate list, and then it goes to the highest tier, which is are they literally maniacs who are shooting up places, for example, which no one has actually done that who's on the list. But I think the most troubling tier is the one that says you cannot associate with someone on the list, because they're going to expand the definition so that you guys are on the list, so that Breitbart is on the list, and then people won't even be able to talk to individuals. For example, I wouldn't be able to interview someone who is, let's say, a white supremacist and confront them on their white supremacy, or interview an anti-Semite and confront them on their anti-Semitism without getting, according to this definition, a point on the hate list. Even if I'm doing it in an adversarial way, I can't associate with them. So if you pose for a photo with someone who is later designated as a hater, you get a point on your score. And this goes back, Sarah, 2 years at least, if not longer. And again, they can move the goalpost tomorrow to 5 years, but they're going back in time. So they could comb through your Facebooks, your Twitters, your Instagrams, whatever. They see a photo with you and one of the hate agents, and then you get a point. And we don't know how many points it is until you get deplatformed, but it's going to happen to all of us. And it's an interesting note, because you're talking a little bit about abortion and Father's Day, and this is my first Father's Day. I have a new baby.
Happy Father's Day.
Thank you. I'm so excited about it. And just know, pro-life content will be hate content at this rate. Mm.
Alex Marlowe, you and I could talk for much longer. Editor-in-Chief of Breitbart News Network, we appreciate all that you do, all you expose. I'm sure we will hear more whistleblower stories as the days unfold. You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships, filling in for Tony Perkins today. Coming up next, Democratic Senator Kristen Gillibrand, one of 20 vying for the White House, accused pro-lifers of being racist. She made that comparison, but Roland Warren, the black president of CareNet, a national movement of life-affirming centers, has something to say just after this.
There is unprecedented religious persecution around the globe. In recent years, research has found increasing governmental and social hostility towards religious believers worldwide. For the last 10 years, Christians have been harassed in more countries, including the United States, than any other religious group. While the specific threats to religious freedom vary in type and intensity, one common source is the legal and cultural support for apostasy, blasphemy, and anti-conversion laws, which often threaten the freedom to choose or change one's faith. in a new publication from Family Research Council. We list which nations around the world have these unjust laws on the books and spotlight people who have faced severe penalties simply for sharing or changing their faith. For more information on religious hostility due to apostasy, blasphemy, and anti-conversion laws around the world, visit frc.org/ABA laws. That's frc.org/ABA laws.
Happy birthday to you.
In states like New York, Virginia, and Vermont, radical legislation has been written legalizing abortion late in pregnancy, when babies can feel pain and are able to live outside the womb.
Happy birthday to you.
They've gone even further, repealing protections of infants born alive, allowing killing even after birth.
Happy birthday, dear.
Congress has yet to protect the life of every newborn baby. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com to send Nancy Pelosi a newborn hat to show Congress every new life should be welcomed with warmth and love, not hate, not death. End birthday abortions. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com.
Happy birthday to you.
Paid for by Family Research Council.
Can United States senators interrogate court nominees on their religious beliefs? This is a controversial question that our country is facing today. In light of this controversy, FRC has taken up the task of answering this question with one of their latest publications, Rebels Without a Clause. We've seen in recent Senate confirmation hearings a troubling pattern arise where senators have begun questioning presidential nominees about their faith as an attempt to discredit them. These interrogations have gone so far as to asking nominees of their theological beliefs, church membership, and associations with faith-based nonprofits. It has been an alarming display of hostility toward religion and people of faith. Visit frc.org/test to learn what questioning the Constitution's No Religious Test Clause allows and forbids in the process of confirming judicial nominees. That's frc.org/test.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships, sitting in for Tony Perkins today. Once again, let me remind you that we are running our baby hat campaign. We are sending, for $9, a baby hat to Congress, directly to Speaker Nancy Pelosi, to encourage her that after 57 tries, it is time to actually bring the Born Alive Infant Survivor Protection Act to the floor for a vote. 218 members have signed the discharge petition. We need 17 more signatures. Your help can come in the way of a $9 contribution. Send your $9. Call this number, 800-225-4008. That's 800-225-4008. For every $9 you give, we will send another newborn baby hat to Pelosi's office. You can also go to TonyPerkins.com, click on the End Birthday Abortion banner. That is 1-800-225-4008. We have employees and operators and assistants and volunteers all eager to hear from you so that we can inundate Speaker Pelosi and let her know there is a giant movement taking place in America to protect those who cannot speak for themselves. Well, let's listen to the unsettling dialogue between Senator Kirsten Gillibrand and a Des Moines Register employer and reporter who was talking to her about her views on abortion and what she thought. So here's the first audio clip.
You've said you're worried about judicial independence, but imposing a litmus test on your nominees has long been seen as an encroachment on judicial independence.
I think there's some issues that have such moral clarity that we have as a society decided that the other side is not acceptable. Imagine saying that it's okay to appoint a judge who's racist or anti-Semitic or homophobic. asking someone to appoint someone who takes away basic human rights of any group of people in America. I don't think those are political issues anymore. All these efforts by President Trump and other ultra-radical conservative judges and justices to impose their faith on Americans is contrary to our Constitution, and that's what this is. There is no moral equivalency when you come to racism. And I do not believe there's a moral equivalency when it comes to changing laws that deny women reproductive freedom.
Well, joining me now with his reaction to this outrageous comparison is Roland Warren, the Black president of CareNet, a national Christ-centered movement of more than 1,000 life-affirming pregnancy centers. He is a graduate of Princeton University and the Wharton School of Business. He spent 20 years in the corporate world with IBM, Pepsi, and Goldman Sachs, and then invested the next 11 as president of the National Fatherhood Initiative before he became where he is now at president of CareNet. Roland, welcome to Washington Watch.
Well, glad to be with you. Thanks so much.
So, Roland, let's talk a little bit about Senator Gillibrand's remarks comparing racist views to pro-life views. How did you respond to this as a Black pro-life leader who understands both of these issues intimately?
Well, the first thing I did was I did a video just to tell people that I'm not a racist. I wanted to make sure that people understood that I was not a racist, that some of my best friends are Black. My mother was Black. My father was Black, and family members were Black. And so I love Black people.
And what a funny thing to have to explain.
Well, I wanted to make sure that that was clear, because I'm also pro-life. And so if being racist is equivalent to being pro-life, I wanted to make sure that people understood that perspective. I mean, obviously it's pretty silly to try to say that I'm a racist, but when you think about what she's saying and the argument that she's making, it really is one that really is disturbing on its head. Because when you think about what real racists actually did, they dehumanized people. They enslaved folks. They lynched people that looked like me. They denied people who looked like me the vote. And interesting, it was all about kind of denying folks the blessings of liberty. Which the first of which is, you know, obviously this whole notion around life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And so the irony of all of this is the fact that this is the foremost blessing. And people who she's seeking to put on the bench are actually folks who want to deny those in the womb the first blessing of liberty, which is life. And so from her perspective, really, I mean, it's exactly backwards, you know, because those folks the folks who have that perspective really don't want people like who look like me to even exist. That would be the best way to do it. And there's really been no policy really that we've had. All the policies that folks, you know, the Klan, whoever it was, none of the work that they ever tried to do or policies they tried to implement have been more effective in making sure that people who look like me don't exist. I mean, over 19 million Black children have been aborted. And, you know, we absolutely are like only 12% of the population, and yet we're 35% of the abortions. So it seems to me that if you really are a racist and you want to make sure that folk who look like me don't exist, there's been no policy that our government has implemented, so to speak, that's been more effective than abortion. And so I wanted to come out and speak about that because I thought it was really significant. And also just to clear it up, to make sure people, folks didn't think I was a racist, because I need to make sure that's clear with people.
What has the reaction been on social media so far? Because what I've seen has really been amazing. This thing has gone completely viral. But are you seeing the same thing?
You know, no, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think part of the issue here is really it's one of these things to just try to shut down debate and really try to shut down any conversation about things by trying to demonize the other side. And instead of attacking the argument, trying to attack people as a class or a group because of what they think. The reality is this issue isn't about race. It's about life. That's really what it's about. It's about life. And the sanctity of life really knows no color. I mean, we're all human, and all human beings are precious and sacred in God's sight, and we're worthy of protection inside and outside the womb. And that's what we're trying to do, give folks inside and outside the womb the opportunity for the blessings of liberty.
Well, I urge our listeners to watch your excellent rebuttal to Senator Gillibrand at care-net.org and be sure to share the video with family and friends. You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry. coming up next as we round the corner to Father's Day in reaction to Gillette's toxic masculinity. SecondVote.com is celebrating the good in men. Robert Kuykendall, executive director of Second Vote, joins me next to discuss.
Did you know that babies survive failed abortions? Sadly, many of these babies are denied their human right to life and are allowed to die. Currently, there is no federal criminal statute in place to protect these babies after they are born alive. Congress and state legislatures across the country have responded by putting forth legislation to protect infants who survive abortion. However, leftist politicians have blocked efforts in Congress and in state legislatures to pass the Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Act, which requires that life-saving medical care be given to babies born alive after failed abortion attempts. We must decide as a country where we stand on the issue of infanticide, to either pursue humane protections for those most vulnerable in our society, or continue to subject innocent human life to the whims of abortionists. For more information, visit frc.org/bornalive. Today, military personnel are at greater risk than ever of suffering from a mental health condition. On average, 21 active and retired military members take their own lives every day. Richard Gleaston, a military and veteran advocate in the area of mental health, recently shared evidence that faith-based solutions can help stop this crisis. Here's what Richard had to say.
There's new science out that they watch people while they're praying or have a religious relationship. The frontal part of their brain, if I'm correct in remembering what they told me, it strengthens it. It reduces depression, reduces anxiety and stress while you're doing it. So not only did God give us prayer as a way to alleviate our spirit, it also alleviates our mind and our bodies. Our bodies react in a positive way to a faith-based relationship.
Visit frc.org/speakers to hear more.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I am Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships here. It's my pleasure to fill in for Tony Perkins. Father's Day is this Sunday. There is no better time to reject the outrageous claim by some, not only in the media, but among big corporations like Gillette, that masculinity is somehow toxic. This came, of course, on the heels of the Me Too movement, and suddenly we found ourselves apologizing alongside the men in our lives and finding ourselves wondering whether or not God created them exactly to be who they are. Well, the pro-life, pro-family group, SecondVote.com, has chosen to honor the father and see the good in men. Joining me now to discuss this is Robert Kuykendall, executive director of our friend at SecondVote.com. Robert, happy Father's Day and welcome to Washington Watch.
Well, thank you for that welcome, Sarah, and happy Flag Day as well to
yes.
you and your listeners.
Indeed, happy Flag Day. Now, let me ask you a question. As somebody who tracks corporate policies at Second Vote, why do you think companies like Gillette have bought into the notion that there is something inherently wrong about men's God-given masculinity?
You know, it sounds strange, doesn't it? Especially because Gillette is a company that markets to men and markets a product designed to deal with something that is caused by men's biological nature. You can't get away from the fact that that males produce facial hair, and that's what Gillette's major line of products is made to deal with. So it's interesting that they would take interesting and troubling that they would take such a line to really carry this narrative that masculinity is somehow toxic. And you and I both know that When we talk about this narrative that seems to be pushed in all, from all corners of the media, we don't excuse boorish behavior. We don't excuse abusers or men who would treat our wives, daughters, mothers, sisters. We don't excuse behavior towards them, but it seems that we sometimes lump masculinity in with these boorish behaviors. And that's what we want to change the focus on and talk about what men are doing that is good. And what, because if we can talk about masculinity and men and the positive traits that those things involve, we're also in the same way, I believe, talking about the good things that women bring to society, to relationships, the good things about femininity and how the feminine natures and the masculine natures are complementary of each other to produce healthy families, which are the most basic and most important building block of a healthy society.
Oh, I could not agree more. Well, your organization, Second Vote, collected stories about men, fathers, and sons from all across America, which I think is a great idea. You wanted people to share how the men in their lives have upheld values that were honorable. And what were some of the things that you heard?
You know, we heard some great stories. I invite your readers or your listeners to come to secondvote.com, and you can see the content we've been posting over the last few weeks. Under the Good in Men, and we've probably got about over a dozen stories that have been submitted from our readers, and we just ask people to tell us, what are the good things, what are the things you admire about the fathers, brothers, sons, husbands, men in your life? You know, what can you tell us? And we had some great stories. We heard about a former Marine who shot down a kamikaze pilot, he said, 20 yards away from the ship he was on. We heard from a lady in New York and Long Island who told us stories, several stories about men of all ages and all backgrounds who work with her at a crisis pregnancy center, including a taxi driver who was taking a young lady to the Planned Parenthood clinic, and he said, "I just can't let you do this," and was able to get this the mother to be to change her mind and get her back to the pregnancy center, and she decided to keep that baby. And then other men who are also there volunteering, painting walls, changing out the carpets. Some great stories. And we actually one of the things we want to do is we gave away a Father's Day gift. Gave way to a man named Fred in Florida. We appreciated the ad. I think you may have seen it. The Eggard Watches, who said, as soon as Gillette came out their ad, Eggard Watches made their own ad and said, let's talk about what men do. Let's talk about how men are brave. Let's talk about how men take risks, how men work risky jobs. And so we decided we were going to give an Eggard Watch to a deserving man based on one of our stories. And Fred's wife, Marie, sent us a great story about how she met Fred. She was a single mother of three children, and she was actually his trainer at General Electric on his first day. And he eventually got to ask her out, and they've been married for over 40 years, and they have a child of their own. But there was a great line in the story, and she said, "You know, he's basically always considered her children as his. And one day someone asked, 'Fred, don't you have only one child?' He bluntly said, 'No, I have four children, and we have been a family for 41 years.
Oh, I love stories like that. What a great word about the importance of fathers and how to cherish their strengths and their honor. Robert Kuykendall, the executive director of our friends at SecondVote.com, has been my guest. To watch the Eggard Watch commercial, go to SecondVote.com/Father's Day. You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry. Coming up next, recent events in higher education have led many to conclude that college campuses are now hotspots for anti-Semitism. But why? Dion Pierre, a research associate with the National Association of Scholars, joins me to discuss his eye-opening column.
Today, military personnel are at greater risk than ever of suffering from a mental health condition. On average, 21 active and retired military members take their own lives every day. Richard Gleaston, a military and veteran advocate in the area of mental health, recently shared evidence that faith-based solutions can help stop this crisis. Here's what Richard had to say.
There's new science out that they watch people while they're praying or have a religious relationship. The frontal part of their brain, if I'm correct in remembering what they told me, it strengthens it. It reduces depression, reduces anxiety and stress while you're doing it. So not only did God give us prayer as a way to alleviate our spirit, it also alleviates our mind and our bodies. Our bodies react in a positive way to a faith-based relationship.
Visit frc.org/speakers to hear more.
If you're like me, you care about the future of our country. Now more than ever, it is vital that we stand up for biblical values. This year, you can. Come to the annual Values Voter Summit in Washington, D.C. on October 11th through the 13th and join thousands of Americans like you who want to change the culture so that human life is valued, families flourish, and religious liberty thrives. This year, we're calling on Americans to pray, to vote, and to stand firm as we fight back to win the culture. Invited and confirmed speakers include Dana Lesh, Sebastian Gorka, Bill Bennett, Laura Ingraham, and Reverend Franklin Graham. Now is the time to stand for truth. There will be opportunities to meet with organizations and attendees that share a biblical worldview on issues like religious liberty, the LGBT movement, the sanctity of life, the realities of socialism, and more. Visit valuesvotersummit.org for more information. That's valuesvotersummit.org. Did you know that babies survive failed abortions? Sadly, many of these babies are denied their human right to life and are allowed to die. Currently, there is no federal criminal statute in place to protect these babies after they are born alive. Congress and state legislatures across the country have responded by putting forth legislation to protect infants who survive abortion. However, leftist politicians have blocked efforts in Congress and in state legislatures to pass the Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Act, which requires that life-saving medical care be given to babies born alive after failed abortion attempts. We must decide as a country where we stand on the issue of infanticide, to either pursue humane protections for those most vulnerable in our society, or continue to subject innocent human life to the whims of abortionists. For more information, visit frc.org/bornalive.
Welcome back again to Washington Watch as we round the corner into this Father's Day weekend. Happy Father's Day to those of you listening who have children of your own, no matter their ages. I hope it's a wonderful, restful time. We thank God for the fathers in our lives and the importance of their roles in our family to make a strong foundation for growing young Americans. Well, one more reminder before I jump into my last segment. Join other pro-life Americans by going to TonyPerkins.com and clicking on the End Birthday Abortion banner. Or call 1-800-225-4008. That's 800-225-4008. For every $9, we will send a baby hat to Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi to urge her to finally permit a vote and protect those who cannot speak for themselves, the youngest, the most fragile and vulnerable among us, the unborn. TonyPerkins.com is also the podcast website. You'll find out more information and get resources on today's guests and referenced publications. Follow Tony on Twitter at T Perkins or me if you'd like at Sarah P. Perry. Well, our last topic today is something about which many of us here at FRC are highly passionate. Passionate because we don't believe enough people are talking about it or recognizing it for what it is, a huge and impending danger to the very civil rights and existence of the population of American Jews. Not only is anti-Semitism a problem overseas, as we've seen with the boycott, divest, and sanction movement, but here there is a rising level of institutional racism, anti-Semitism on college campuses and universities. Oberlin College professor Joy Correga asserted in November 2016 that U.S. intelligence agencies had conspired with Israel to commit the Charlie Hebdo massacre. In April 2018, Professor Kwame Zulu Shabazz of Knox College tweeted that Jews are pulling these strings for profit. And in July 2018, Stanford University student and resident assistant Hamez Daoud declared his intent to physically fight Zionists on campus. Online Jewish magazine The Allgemeiner, with whom we've worked, now maintains a list of the top 40 worst colleges for Jews in North America. We are so passionate about the issue that our senior fellow here for regulatory affairs, Dr. Chris Gasek, has written an issue analysis, Left-Wing Anti-Semitism, the Greatest Campus Threat is Ignored. Go to frc.org and search publications. We have also here at FRC recently submitted statements to the UN. The Special Reporter on Religious Freedom or Belief, the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, about the institutional anti-Semitism at American universities. So joining me now is someone who is exceptionally qualified to talk about this. His intriguing column at thedailysignal.com will have many of you talking. Dion Pierre is a research associate with the National Association of Scholars and is co-author of the book, Neo-Segregation in American Higher Education. Dion, welcome to Washington Watch.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm excited to talk about this today because truly we do not here at FRC and many of our friends do not believe this is a topic about which we are being honest intellectually or concerned sufficiently. You note in your piece, which just premiered this week at the Daily Signal, Victor Davis Hanson had observed that colleges are becoming incubators for progressive hatred of Jews. But why higher education particularly? Why is it in these environments that anti-Semitism has suddenly become respectable?
Particularly because higher education is embracing what Peter Wood and I called neo-segregation, which is driven by a form of racial tribalism that is conducive to this kind of conspiratorial thinking. It has roots in a strain of black nationalism that emerged in the 1960s that has always had Jews in its mind and in its consciousness as a bad force in American life.
So most coverage of anti-Semitism on campus has focused on the left and what I previously referred to, the BDS movement and pro-Palestinian student groups. So can you explain for those listeners we have who are not familiar what the BDS, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanction movement, actually entails?
They are an organization that is funded by organizations that have connections to terrorists, and they don't believe that Israel should exist, and they say that it is an imperial power that is guilty of all kinds of human rights violations.
So it's becoming an increasing dialogue. In fact, so prevalent is this dialogue about BDS and anti-Semitism that even just this Tuesday, Marco Rubio sharply criticized, according to one of your reporters, just prior to the publication of your own article, that the BDS movement falsely masquerades as a crusade for free speech. But let me read to you Senator Rubio's quote. "Let's pass the resolution condemning anti-Semitism, and then let's put some muscle behind it by passing a bill that actually gives states the ability to go after anti-Semitism disguised as economic policy and disguised as a free speech argument." I find this so very compelling in today's day and age. So we hear so often about BDS. We now understand that there is sort of an ancillary to BDS, a secondary leg to this foundation of rising institutional anti-Semitism. But you and Peter Wood discovered this topic, this concept of neo-segregation in higher education. Can you explain more in depth what that neo-segregation looks like?
Neo-segregation is the voluntary racial segregation of students in residential dorms on college campuses, orientation programs that happen before the year begins, and in graduation ceremonies, and in some cases, even field trips. I found a handful of student of color retreats or faculty of color retreats at various colleges. Oftentimes, it gets very bad on college campuses. In 1996, the black students living in the Malcolm X house tossed out several non-black students who applied to live there because of the color of their skin. It gets very toxic.
The article title, how this is sort of the function of the new woke activism on campus. I love that title. So I want to talk about this concept of wokeness. We hear about this predominantly from younger generations, but for people like me who are in our, you know, mid-40s, though I hate to admit it, but hey, what do we have to hide? We are not as familiar with such a term. This is a concept arising out of higher education, institutions of higher learning. Woke politics is what kind of an ideology? What does this mean if you call an ideology like anti-Semitism woke?
Mm-hmm. Woke is a branch of resentment politics or identity politics, as we're all used to calling it. And I think David Brooks kind of got it right last year, I believe it was, when he said that it needs to be aware and paranoid. Basically, to be woke is to be absolutely sure that white Americans are out to get black Americans, that institutional racism keeps black Americans down, and woke activists seek out enemies. And from the 1960s, when the kind of woke activism we're familiar with first began to form, Jews have figured prominently in the woke consciousness as people pulling the strings and not acting sincerely with black Americans. There has been a degree of anti-Semitism in the black American zeitgeist throughout American history, but it became something that was mainstream in the 60s and something that no one really said anything about. When I believe Stokely Carmichael and his organization, he purged all of the white members, and by that he meant all the Jewish members, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. So this has happened in the 1960s. A member of the NAACP blamed riots in Philadelphia on Jewish merchants. So it's something that's very toxic, and that's been happening. And someone like Malcolm X, who had all kinds of insane ideas about Jews, this whole Nation of Islam eschatology that had Jews living in caves. And there are dorms and halls and lounges named after Malcolm X at colleges across the country. At Wesleyan University, Malcolm X has an entire dorm named after him. And no one has a conversation about anti-Semitism. So it's a very bad situation, and students aren't learning about this.
No, they are not. In fact, if anything, they are learning that this individual, Malcolm X, who was the leader of the Black Nationalist Movement in the 60s, is an American hero. But what you do not hear, but what I will refer to for purposes of educating the audience, is that Malcolm X believed in something called Jacob's history, which is the foundational myth of the Nation of Islam. We've talked about Islam before. We've talked about its threats to national security. But let's talk specifically about the origins here. This Jacob's history teaches that whites and Jews were created 6,000 years ago by Jacob, an evil scientist. And Malcolm X was frequently quoted as talking about the fact that whites, including Jews, created by Jacob, dwelled, as you said, in caves until, quote, Allah raised up Moses to civilize them. So you are essentially resting on the shoulders of the forefather of black nationalism and rising anti-Semitism, the mantle of what eventually happened on college campuses, which is now this resurgence of these pockets of black nationalism. So after the 60s, sort of the next upswing, the next groundswell, were black students at Yale University who sort of took up the mantle of anti-Semitism in the 1980s. Can you describe it for us?
Yeah. Things got very intense at Yale University in the 80s. The black students there were upset that Jewish students took umbrage at anti-Semitic remarks made by Jesse Jackson in the 1980s. He referred to Jews as, Heinies, and a Jewish section of New York as Heine Town. This created all kinds of fuss in the 80s. You know, Louis Farrakhan came out and said that Jews were going to attempt to murder Jesse Jackson. And so the response by black students and the Black Student Alliance at Yale was to actively work with Jesse Jackson's campaign at an event at Yale. This young man, Millard Owens, you know, he said that, you know, in so many words, that blacks and Jews had been set at odds, and that he encountered landowners and store owners and social workers who were Jews in his community, that blacks had encountered them and had poor relations with them. And, you know, this is something that you see in Malcolm X, complaints about Jewish landlords, people looking to buy up property, people creating tension, making things hard for blacks. And it spread to other universities as well. It also became respectable at SUNY Stony Brook. They invited this poet, Amiri Baraka, to be a professor there, and he wrote in his poetry about his desire to kill Jews. At Louis Farrakhan was invited to Wesleyan University in 1985, and Jewish students there protested to no avail. Farrakhan, as you know, called Judaism a gutter religion, and he's made a career out of anti-Semitism. So it's something that isn't spoken about to the detriment of the country. There is all this bubbling race nationalism, and we aren't really having a conversation about what that means about the generation of students coming up today. That colleges haven't come out against this is a scandal.
It is indeed. You point out in your article that each of these stories, and there is an excellent chronology, race nationalist demagogues pouring their contempt on Jews and depicting them as a hidden force is really the motivating factor here. It is the thing they share in common. So let me ask you a final question. How can we address anti-Semitism, and how can we fight it?
Boy, for one, we have to teach college students. College students don't read anymore, so I wonder how many students have read the King James Bible, secular or not, and learn the story of the Jews, and I've learned that anti-Semitism is the world's oldest form of hatred, and it tends to reemerge in societies that are very sick, and I think a lot of people of faith, would agree that ours is. That's a starting point, and what we can do to fight it is to talk honestly about it. People often coddle black activists and intellectuals and don't call them out when they stir up this kind of hatred. But black Americans are an intellectual force in the country, and black nationalists played a huge role in shaping the modern, black zeitgeist and the modern left. And we need to talk about these evil forms of hatred that have trailed that. So I regret
Dion Pierre
on college campuses. Yeah.
Dion Pierre has been my excellent guest today. He is an author. He is a pundit. His recent column appears at the Daily Signal. This has been Washington Watch. Go to frc.org to search for more resources, or tonyperkins.com, where you can visit our End Birthday Abortions campaign. We'll see you next time on Washington Watch.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit tonyperkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234.
That's 1-866-372-7234.